The vision is to have the easiest platform for developers. So that's
Okay.
the number one vision.
Hi everyone. Before we begin this episode, I just want to say that there's been a technical issue in the recording, so that's why the screen sharing probably doesn't work as well as expected. So what I've done is I left a link in the show note below. Please open it so you can see MoTV and Dick during the his event presentation. Hope you guys do enjoy the show. Thank you for watching. And welcome to Colors of Web3 and Entrepreneurship. My name is Lam. I'm your typical Web3 host. And today, here I am back to the Web3 world again. I'll be talking to Ivan Miskovic, who is the CBO, as he calls himself, Chief Business Officer of MultiVM.io, a Web3 startup. Ivan, can you give us a quick introduction about yourself?
Yeah, certainly. Hi, I'm Ivan, running business, all stuff business at MultiVM, which is a new layer two on the Ethereum blockchain.
Cool. Before we dive into your company, actually, I would like to get to know a little bit more about you. Can you tell us more about your professional working experience, maybe like before Web3 day and then like after Web3 and then leading up to your current current company?
Yeah, sure. My background is tied to startups since I'm basically 18. Started my first company back then during university, and then went to work for a company builder, which is called Rocket Internet, pretty famous in Europe, and I think also in Southeast Asia. They have built number of unique. Worked there for a couple of years. Was headhunted by a private equity firm to invest in technology companies, mostly in the consumer internet space, like Web 2. And then I joined the Web3 space in 2020 professionally, first also as an investor, and then later on as an operator for MultiVM, basically Spin, which now rebranded to MultiVM.
Nice. I see. Your first company. What sort of company was it?
The first company was in 20. That was like a student project. We were trying to build like Instagram, but with a shoppable feed. So imagine like a social e-commerce thing. So you see some influencer wearing stuff, and then you can click on the picture and buy
Yeah.
this.
Really?
It was like back then, that was the biggest hype, like Instagram, Tinder, all of these things came out around that time, and everyone was hyped about, social and e-commerce, basically mobile commerce.
Interesting. So, did you get some good traction for that project company?
Yeah, I think we had like 100K users, but at the end of the day, we were way too young to be taken serious and raise
That's quite
any money
impressive.
or or have like any meaningful traction. But we had like these
Yeah.
niche of, I don't know, it was teenage people or teenage users who were loving the app. So that was actually a good indicator. But we had also like hundreds of competitors. Like I think more or less every other student were doing something similar.
Okay, I see. So it was like somewhat of a common ideas back then, yeah.
Yeah, that
Right?
was the idea of, I think if you had asked like 10 people who were young back then, nine would have said, hey, yeah, let's make some sort of social commerce, whatever.
I see. And then what was the first thing that actually brought you into Web3? Like how did you heard about Web3? Was it through some trading, investment, Bitcoin news, or what was it?
Oh, it was the darknet, actually.
Oh, really? Darknet.
Yeah, like my cousin came to me and said, hey man, like there is this cool thing, it's called Tor Network, and I was like, what is that? And he was like, oh, this is like the real internet. And yeah, just we were kids, like maybe, I don't know, we weren't even, I think, adults. And we were browsing that, and then you had these coins, right? You had like Bitcoin. I think Doge was already out.
Really?
Not sure about others. I'm 100% that Doge was there and Bitcoin was there.
What year was this?
12-ish, something like
Oh,
this.
wow. You're
12,
early.
yeah, 11, 12. And that's
Yeah,
where I
still
learned
early.
about it initially. For me, that was more or less the currency of the darknet. Like, I never thought about this becoming an asset, honestly. It took me like 10 more years, I think, to realize, because even when the first pump started of Bitcoin, I was like, yeah, that's some sort of bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, that's some, you know, fake thing, you know, like some glitch in the matrix or something like that. And then I realized, okay, this is not dying, right? Like, even when Mt. Gox collapsed, I was like 100% sure this was like, just all of this was like a huge scam, right? That was my initial idea. Because when Mt. Gox died or got hacked or whatever happened there.
Yeah, it got hacked big time. Yeah.
The whole thing collapsed. Like, it was just, you couldn't buy or sell any Bitcoins. Like, that was it. Like, people just lost everything that they had. Any way to meaningfully trade these things or buy them. And for me back then, it was okay. This was like a huge scam. And all of these guys are behind this, and this is just, you know, this was just another hype or something. But Bitcoin survived, and here we are.
Yeah.
Now the Bitcoin ETF got approved.
Yeah, exactly. Bitcoin ETF got approved like earlier today, which is crazy too. Yeah. Crazy news. Yeah. And I think, if I heard correctly, the people who got hacked during the Mt. Gox also got money returned, right? Maybe after so many years, right?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I never bought Bitcoin back then. Portion. I couldn't buy it because I was underage. I didn't even have a credit card. Like,
okay.
What should I tell my parents? Like, hey, you know what? I need this fake internet money, you know, to buy what exactly? So not gonna happen.
It's true, but I thought that in the Dagnet you don't need KYC, right? I mean, that's the idea.
No, the but you need to buy this somehow, right? I think the way to buy it. You would send money to Mt. Gox by a wire transfer credit card, and they would send you bitcoins, right? So that was kind of the deal. But it was like the first sex. It started like as a Magic the trading cards, you know, Magic the Gathering. So it started.
Oh yes, yeah.
It started like a platform where you could trade those, right? So, and then they just pivoted to Bitcoin. So that was the first,
the first centralized exchange ever.
Yeah,
awesome. Anyway, can you share with us a bit about your hobbies outside of Web3?
Oh, I have two kids, and I spend most of my time with my kids.
Oh, I see.
And they are both very small. Like, one is a baby. She is 6 months, and the other is 1.5 years old.
Oh, so lovely.
Basically,
spending I'm sure
all day with them.
Your hands are full, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's not a lot of time for hobbies.
I bet. Okay. Anyway, without further ado, let's go ahead and deep dive into your current company, MultiVM.io. Please feel free to share any slides or company website that you have at the stage.
Yeah, sure. I can share a screen. So, I mean, I'll just walk you through this and explain, like, maybe not even using the deck so much. So, what we started with was Spin Finance, and Spin Finance is a perp dex, that's a trading platform on the Near blockchain. So we have spot trading there, we have perp trading, and we have decentralized option vaults. So all in all is three products in one platform tied together with shared functionality. And what we realized is, there is a lot of projects like Spin out there who are trying to get a new success in the form of going to a new chain or additional chains. So why don't they do this? Is because if you are built on a non-Ethereum virtual machine blockchain, it's very cost prohibitive to go somewhere else. The EVM has this unique benefit that most of the code is recyclable. So what happens is, I can show this maybe here. So all of these chains are EVM, like Ethereum, Arbitrum, Polygon, Optimism, Tron also has a fork of the EVM, ZK Sync, and many, many more.
Yeah.
And then you have on the other side, alternative virtual machines. So Solana has Solana VM, or C-level, what they call. Cosmos has something called Cosm Vasm VM. Then you have Algorand with the Algorand VM. Aptos has its own. Near has its own. Sui. Starknet has its own VM. Telegram Network has its own VM. So let's say, imagine you are an entrepreneur and you have built something on, let's say a Cosm Vasm thing. Or let's say on Telegram. It doesn't really matter where. Now you are stuck with this code, this product on this blockchain. You can't go to any other blockchain, basically, easily. You can if you hire more developers, if you hire more people to help you do this, because most oftentimes the language is different, and certainly the instructions are always different. And for many projects, this would be interesting to be able to just magically push a button and be on a new blockchain with the same code they have. And that's what we allow. So we allow projects to basically take their code, which they already have, of a button, be on a new blockchain, and which is our blockchain. Because our blockchain is very unique in a sense that we have not just one virtual machine, but multiple virtual machines. So that's where the name comes from. And you can basically now today take your code and post it on the Solana virtual machine or Ethereum virtual machine, and both work together in our multi-VM environment. And they work together, not just that it's like coexisting, but you can also, as a user, use both of those. So what that means is you can, as a user, use your normal wallet, you use like MetaMask, whatever, Wallet Connect. And now you can access a smart contract from Solana or from the Ethereum world, and you can bridge information without using basically a bridge very, very fast, like in one transaction, as if those smart contracts were built on the same virtual machine. And that's how we achieved this basically with a lot of code. So hundreds or thousands of adopters who make these virtual machines synchronously work together. And you, as a user, you wouldn't even notice. Is this a Solana project? Is this a Ethereum project? Is this a project from Algorand? It doesn't really matter for you. You can just access the smart contracts. And same as like in Ethereum, you can say, okay, I now want to take a position in Mango Markets, let's say, which is a Solana project, and I want to hedge it on Uniswap, which is an Ethereum project, without bridging between these blockchains. So this is basically what multi-VM allows, in a nutshell.
So basically, user would have to interact through your VM, like your platform?
Yeah, the user would connect in the same way you're connecting today to Arbitrum, for example. You connect with your wallet, let's say MetaMask, you deploy money onto our blockchain, and now you can access projects from many different virtual machines, where previously you would have to bridge between all those proxies. So previously, let's say this is not possible, because you would have to bridge from Solana to Cosmos, or from Cosmos to Arbitrum. And so you cannot, let's say, use GMX together with Osmosis from Cosmos, right? You can bridge money between those, but this is like a hard process and it takes time and it's not like seamless, right? What we allow is, for builders, any code you have, you can deploy it. For users, access any project you want without having to bridge money around.
Interesting. So then, how would it work? Maybe like a token on Solana, how would that function?
Yeah, exactly.
On Ethereum, you know?
That's a very good question. Yeah. And here's the same answer. So we have standardized in the backend using adapters, fragments, which we call, so fragments and fragments are sort of, imagine like messages, right? So it's like, it's not full data, like the full data isn't transpiled, but it's like fragments of metadata which are going across our execution layer, and they are basically transporting the information, and these adapters are managing and synchronizing the different token standards, the wallet standards, the instructions, because it's not just the token standard which is different. So now imagine this. The Solana VM has a specific set of instructions, right? Let's say a code for getting tokens is like, I don't know, get underlying token, right? On Ethereum is, I don't know, transfer underlying token. So that's just an example. Not real, but like it's the reality is really like that. So the difference is really in the instruction. So how do we know what to do, right? So what we have is adapters, which adapt the code, feed it into what we call a meta contract. And the meta contract you can think about like as a god contract. So the meta contract sees everything and manages everything automatically. Now the information gets pushed from the EVM to the adapter. The meta contract sends it to a fragment to our host environment. And from there, information is parsed back to the SVM in a SVM readable way. Again, from the SVM readable way to adapter, and then from the adapter to the EVM. So basically, this is the technological moat we have built, because replicating that requires thousands of developers' hours. So this is really hard to replicate.
Yeah, it seems quite hard also. How many, I'm curious now when you said that, how many developer hours have been put into this?
Look, our team, we are working together for a pretty long time. Like two of the developers are brothers, so they are working since they are born, I assume, together on code. So we are very fast in shipping code, which we also have proved on Near. So just to give you an example, we were the first on Near to build a spot trading order book, the first to build the perp futures, and the first to build the DOVs. So we beat everyone to market. And for us, it took like, I would say 8 months of daily work, like Monday to Sunday. Like a couple of hours, I would say maybe 8 hours per day or 9 hours per day.
Impressive, Monday to Sunday.
Like that's really like, and we were like super fast. And this, in a like corporate setting, if we weren't a startup, I would say this would take probably 2 years.
Wow. Structure. Okay. So then, interesting. What phase is your product in project in right now for MotiVM?
Yeah, so for now we have a private testnet, which is still pretty, I would say, not stable. We haven't rolled it out to the public yet because stuff is just crashing down, etc. And I explain to you why this is, because you can see here that there is a lot of elements to building a blockchain. So this execution environment or layer, which we call like the MVM layer, this is built, but we have to build this bridge. For example, this is where we are spending most of our time currently, which is also a ZK bridge. Then we have data availability services and work with the DA layer. Like all of these things, like RPC, block scanners, everything has to be built from scratch, and this just takes time to look and feel solid, right? We cannot alter something to the world where you, when you press a button, for example, the block explorer doesn't work. So users expect when they see a testnet that everything more or less works. So that's why we are still in private testnet. But it pretty much blew my mind when I saw it the first time. I was like, okay, is this real? And it is. So in a couple of months, developers from Solana, Ethereum, and other blockchains will be able to just push a button and recycle their existing code on MultiVM.
That's impressive. Yeah, I'm really looking. But I'm curious now. Is it not possible to reuse some of the other, you know, components like Prover, DA service? I know there's some company like doing data availability in RPC.
Exactly. No. At DA, we are not building the whole DA layer ourselves. We are working with partners, especially in the DA. But a lot of the things we have is very custom made, so it's not really out of the box, right? So you cannot it's cheaper and easier to build it yourself than to modify with something, which is something which is existing. To give you an example from the real world, imagine you're kind of building a house. It's always easier and cheaper to build a new one than to say, okay, this is an existing solution, like an old house, and let's renovate it. So
yeah.
This is like, you cannot build a skyscraper out of a small cottage house. You have to have the like real thing, like the foundation, etc.
Yeah.
We are here building like super complex tech. So we are building much of the things ourselves.
I see. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, if I were to view a bigger building, I would probably have to demolish, right?
Everything doesn't work
from scratch. Yeah.
Yeah. So you'd spend more time and effort to make other stuff work than to build it yourself outright. That's mostly our learning.
I see. And how many people are in your team at the moment with TVM?
10 people, out of which I am the only business person.
Okay, so basically 9 developers.
Exactly.
One, yeah. Awesome. No wonder why you guys do so fast. Yeah.
As I said, like two of our guys are brothers, and we have one brilliant person. She is the best developer I ever met in my life. And she is the brain behind of all this. Very shy. So I don't think that she will go to any podcast anytime soon. But she is the brain behind all of this, more or
less. I see. So did she come up with this idea? Or did you come up with this idea? Or like how did this whole...
No, I mean, how do we create some solution for projects like Spin to scale, right? So because, as I said, Spin exists on Near. We have some relatively good TVL, relatively good trading volume, never got hacked. Like the community in Near likes Spin. And we were like, okay, now we have achieved something, but like, how do we bring it to the next level, right? So that was always the question for us.
Yeah.
And she went home and was like, okay, I have this, thing which I kind of already know how to build. And then she told us, like, I just basically took the Solana VM and Ethereum VM and a bunch of other virtual machines, and I made them work together. And we're like, what do you mean you made them work together? Yeah, it was like a site project of hers, like privately, and it works like in the prototype setting. And then we were like, okay, this is brilliant, right? So and then we dig deeper into that, changed the name eventually into MultiVM, so because all of us loved this idea so much, and the feedback from the market was very good. So every builder we are talking to, doesn't matter which blockchain, loves this, because if you're coming from EVM, now your smart contract can interact with, let's say, a Solana VM project, right? Which is something new. Or if you're coming from another non-EVM side, you can tap into the Ethereum market. So users who only use MetaMask can access your project. Like, because people don't know it. Like, many Ethereum users, let's say, don't know that MetaMask only works for Ethereum. So once you... leave Ethereum, you have the first challenge. Okay, which wallet do you use? And MetaMask is the number one wallet in the world. So,
I think so. By number of users, I think that totally makes sense. But then, I think I still have some like question. Maybe some of the technical question about like how a lot of these like talk to each other, because I know that there's even different programming languages, right?
Exactly.
Smart contract written in Solana is different from smart contract written on Sui, and then different from smart contract written on EVM.
Exactly. Yeah, so the language really is different. Yeah. Instructions. Yeah. Everything is different. And that's what makes this challenging. And this is what I try to explain in this slide. So at the bottom of it, we have something which is a general purpose virtual machine. And basically, this is the backbone of everything, where everything compiles down to. And these instances of the virtual machines I'm talking about, like EVM, SVM, etc., are living on top of this. You could imagine it like this. And now they are managed by this meta contract, which synchronizes the languages, instructions using adapters. So for example, this adapter converts Solidity code into streamlined code for the meta contract to read. And then the meta contract can send, again, information to another adapter, right? Which is streamlining this information to SVM. So basically, imagine these adapters, and the meta contract is some sort of translators, or let's say transformers of code, which are transforming it into readable code for our brain in the backend. And the brain in the backend manages all things and sends and manages and resources, gas fees, information, all of the thing you need is streamlined here and translated back to the adapter, which is then giving the instructions in the right language to the virtual machine. So imagine the virtual machine getting instructions in Solidity, passing these instructions from Solidity to the adapter. The adapter converts it into the special code we are using. And then the brain learns about it. And then the brain gives the information back to Solana in a different language. And then it goes back, for example, if it's, this is like a, just a basic cross VM call from EVM to Solana. This is how it would work. The user comes from the outside, right? He gives an instruction to the brain, right? Well, let's say we call this host. And then from the brain, it goes down to the meta contract. The meta contract sends it to the adapter. The adapter sends it in an understandable way to the EVM. So let's say the instruction is call the SVM. Now the EVM is saying, okay, I want to call the SVM, sends it to the adapter, goes back to this host process. The SVM says, okay, I'm accepting this call, sending it back to the adapter in its own language, and then the final confirmation lands in the EVM. So, and now imagine all the different possibilities of code, how much code and functions there are. And we have basically built these adapters for all of those instructions and utility.
I see. So basically for every blockchain that has a separate, like, let's say virtual machine, let's say Sui or Say, and you would have to, I guess, look and understand some of the functions, right? And then convert
all of the
respective adapters, right?
You take basically the whole virtual machine, put it inside of here, build another adapter for it, or many adapters, and then this virtual machine can work together with the other. And we want to make this also this system permissionless, and it's all open source. So what that means is kind of, in the future, our idea is we want to have those things updated, right? So it's like a little bit like a SaaS tool. So not in the payment way of SaaS, but in a way that you, as a user, as a developer, you can always be sure that we will have the newest, latest instance of the EVM. Same with the newest, latest instance of the SVM. So if the SVM changes through a hard fork or something, we will also do the changes on our side. So you as a developer can always take the code which you kind of, let's say Solana is your home base, now you change something on your home base, you can with one click changes on multi VMs.
Okay, but then for each of the new VM, let's say Sui VM to EVM, and then so you would need to write a different adapter than Sui to Solana, right?
Yes.
Wow, that's quite a lot. Yes. I mean, I can already do some like simple mathematics to see how many adapters you need to
exactly. To write for that, and then this all has to be optimized. So the more, like in this space, generally how it works is that the more easier the instruction, or maybe not easy, the simpler the code, the better, because it's less. Like less vectors to get hacked, first of all. The cleaner the code, the less like you use, the better. So the adapters are really the ingenious way, right? This is like really where our biggest defensibility is against everyone else. Like the adapters are the, I would say the adapters will be the most important thing, or are the most important thing in this whole thing. Like in the meta.
I see. So then a token, would it still exist on its own native blockchain, or would it exist on your okay.
Of course. Of course. So you would have the Solana tokens on the SVM and the EVM tokens on the EVM. Now, if you wanted to switch them, there would be some adapting going on so that the EVM understands that this is like a Solana token, this is a token. It would show here, but also in a wrapped version. So it wouldn't be the exact same token, but it would be a bridgeless, I would say, transfer of the token. So the value would be transferred basically because this system makes track of all your accounts and all the money on all of the valuables, like NFTs or something like that. And now you can bring those and basically transfer those from the different virtual machines without using a bridge. But there would be some technological indication that this is not the exact, like you cannot have a Solana token on EVM, but you can have a ERC20 token, which is basically the representation of the Solana.
So you have to look for the existing contract on like
Exactly.
ERC20.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you have to do
So
the
it would
corresponding map.
be, yeah, exactly. It would be, but it's, as I said, it's all managed by this meta contract, which is basically the brain behind all of this. This is kind of, imagine this like as a huge ledger, which says, okay, there is like a Solana token standard to contract here, and it has so much, and now the ERC20 contract has so much, and when you kind of do cross arbit, or let's say cross QM calls, one has less and one has more. But you can like imagine it like that.
Interesting. But then where does the liquidity come from then?
The liquidity is
With that
shared,
when you
so
swap, I'll
it's like,
share. Okay.
yeah. So the liquidity is shared. This is the cool thing because it's one blockchain. It's not different blockchains, right? The liquidity is all at one place. So this is like looking like this. Let me show it. So the liquidity would come from Ethereum, let's say layer one, to the EVM, and it is like a shared storage where the liquidity is stored. So you can, let's say, bridge from Solana to this to this system. You can bridge from Ethereum. You can bridge from all that. We want to have all the bridges to multi-EVM. And once the money is bridged inside, you can easily transfer it across different virtual machines.
Okay, I see. And it would exist inside your multi-VM environment, right?
In a common storage. So let's say you send $100 from Solana to the common storage and $100 from Ethereum, right? You would have 200 in your account on multi.
Got it. Okay. And is there a way I can bridge it back? Let's say if I put
Exactly.
USDC. Okay.
Sure, of course. I mean, bridges work in two ways, typically. So
I hope. Right? I hope. I don't know. I don't know. I just have to ask.
I would love to have it one way, but like, I don't think that users would love it.
Exactly, right? People will be like, oops, and now I have only a multi-VM only token. They probably want like, okay, that makes sense
Yeah, no, it like we don't have our like we have our own virtual machine which we call Fragment,
then.
because we were thinking, okay, since we are spending so much time with virtual machines, let's build our native one, which we think is the best. But you can use Solana, you can use adding more bring forward.
I see. And what are some of the challenges facing your team? I mean, it sounds like a very complex project.
Yeah, it's mostly technological challenges, obviously. But then also on the BD side, the conception in the space is whatever you do, people expect some value back, right? And even though we are trying to build the least friction for people to build on this, like we are trying to make it as easy as possible to deploy a multi-VM. We still get questions like, well, do we get a grant? And I'm like, for what? I mean, this is like a day's of work, right? How much money do you need for that? Like, we can give you like, $10,000 if this is, but this is like way more than you have in expenses. And people are like, yeah, but I still have to pay for AWS and stuff like that. And like, it's always because it's so much implemented in the brains of the entrepreneurs that they are getting grants for anything they do. Even the easiest task you have to kind of monetize or give money for, which is an interesting concept because in the normal Web2 space this never happens, right? Like You go to AWS and you expect to pay for your service and not the other way around.
But I mean, to be fair, AWS do give out like some little funding for the AWS, right? I think like 5,000, 10,000, like little credit, right? To motivate startup to try out.
Yeah,
but I know what you mean. It's like a challenge with Web3, right? You need incentive for people to come. And I'm guessing your vision for this is like to be like a huge platform, right? For people to come and build on. And
I mean, that's why we are doing it. We want to make it as easy as possible. And when I say as easy as possible, I really mean one click. You can imagine the difference between today and with multi-VM. So imagine you have a Solana project and you want to go to Ethereum. So what that would mean today is you would have to take all the code you have and transform it and transpile it or recode, better said, refactor into Solidity, from Rust to Solidity. But the instructions would also have to totally change, etc. Probably hire two or three Solidity devs, depending on the size of your project in Solana. And this whole process will cost you between 100K and a million, or even more, and 6 to 1 month to 1 year. So now imagine the cost-benefit analysis for many entrepreneurs when they say, okay, am I going to go from, let's say, Solana to Arbitrum, or add Arbitrum in addition to Solana, because you don't leave Solana, but like you want to add one more network. And if your cost is $1 million and the benefit is maybe not clear, you will not do it, right? And with multi-VM, it's really like a day or two. And that changes the whole, I mean, decision-making process.
I see. And your vision for this is to have many, what is your vision? I'm curious. Like, do you hope to have many people building smaller apps protocol, building, like, bring your own blockchain?
No, the vision is clear. The vision is to have the easiest platform for developers. So that's the number one vision. So the easiest, I mean, like, you have some code, great. You can just reuse it. You want to build some new code, and you can only build it on this specific VM, you can use it. But you don't have to sacrifice liquidity or stuff like this, or connectivity or alignment with Ethereum. You want to have, you know, multiple virtual machines. Your project is working, or you want to build a project which will make use of, let's say, two virtual machines. You can do this here as well. So I want to give the best design space and best environment, easiest to use, most seamless to developers.
Yeah, got it. I think that makes sense. Yeah, because I think, let's say, lately there's been a lot of you know, activity going on in Solana, but I think people still want to maybe somehow attract more activity or liquidity from Ethereum, right? EVM, and then they can probably do that.
Exactly.
With your,
and also, like, the security standards of Ethereum are pretty high, and since we are building this as a roll-up to Ethereum, or let's say aligned blockchain to Ethereum, we are taking a lot of the security pros from Ethereum, like the a lot of the security benefits you get, or most of them, from Ethereum when you use multi-VM. So this is also relevant for a lot of people, right? Security and level of decentralization. And here in these two categories, Ethereum is definitely a leader. Like, when it comes to decentralization and safety, Ethereum is, next to Bitcoin, probably the most decentralized and safe blockchain. The only thing which is a little bit difficult with Ethereum is scalability. And now we are bringing a new dimension to scalability, where we say, it's not just about the Solidity code and the Solidity projects, but on EVM, we want to bring all those different code bases, virtual machines to it.
Nice. Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you're still on the private testnet, but I'm quite curious. Is there any, like, a small glimpse of the demo or anything that I can see for the
product? I can't. I would love to show. Oh, no? I would love to show it. But unfortunately, today I will not.
Good.
Mean,
no worry.
We can do this probably, like, in a few weeks. I can show you the first,
sure,
or I can show you the demo.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see in the future. When right now you said you have like 10 people and working like what, 7 days a week. So yeah, I'm quite curious how do you keep your team motivated, right? Because I think a lot of teams like suffer from like burnout, right? Because we both know that in Web3 people work a lot, work like crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I would say that once you have a big vision, it's easier
Yeah.
to motivate people. That's my experience. So people love to work on big, bold stuff. Most people, right? If you tell
Yeah.
someone to build the 100th version of I don't know, an AMM,
Uniswap,
right?
Uniswap,
Yeah.
yeah.
So it's a little bit, probably for most people demotivating. Unless it's like a pure money grab, like unless it's like you say, okay, I'm gonna pay you this amount per month and that's it. Right? It's like no spirit behind that. It's like just give me the money, I'm gonna do it. I gotta work my 6 hours or 8 hours a day. I mean, but effectively what I learned, like effectively people work like between 4 to 6 hours a day if they work full time. Like this is what I learned
Yeah.
kind of from managing people. And you can expect that you will get like 4 to 6 hours of meaningful real work if
Yep.
someone is kind of working his 8 hour day. Because there is a lot of, instances where people are like thinking about stuff, not doing like the work they should do, going out for eating something. Like there is all these like small things in their day, and no one works like 12 hours productively. Like that's impossible. And
It's very rare.
but if you have like a bigger, bolder vision where you say, okay, if you succeed with this, it will be a much, much higher impact on the world, or let's say in this industry, than if you do this. That motivates people to work extra. To say, okay, I'm gonna open my MacBook or whatever you work on a Saturday at 10 p.m. instead of, watching a movie. Or on a Sunday at morning, right? Instead of, I don't know, going to church. So like that's where the difference is between, okay, this is my corporate or let's say job where I'm building something like what I don't like, but I need to because of the money, versus I'm building something really meaningful. And you see that mostly in, for example, the companies Elon Musk leads, right? It's always very bold things he does. So electric cars with AI, fucking hard to do, right?
Yeah, his
But the
AI is
people
amazing,
who
by the way.
work there are seeing that and can be proud of what they do, right? They can say, okay, I am basically working for a maniac who demands like crazy things from me, but if we succeed, we are changing the world, right? Same with SpaceX, right? Or same with, I don't know, Neuralink. But if you're working as a, I don't know, systems engineer for an accounting company, right? And that's like, I don't think that you are in the same way motivated as if you would build rocket.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the mission and the goal, like you said, is totally on point. It really
Exactly.
motivate people. Yeah, and I also agree with the part that for full-time employees, like typically 4 or 6 hours is basically what's expected, right? And especially for developers, I think we both know that for developer you need like these flow, right? Get into the flow state. So it takes some time, right? Yeah, because once you break out of the flow, yeah, it takes like half an hour, maybe an hour to get back into
I mean,
coding.
but I think it's for many other people as well. It's not just for developers.
Yeah,
You could
true.
be, I don't know, content writer, and if you're really into it, and like you have 3 or 4 hours which are very productive, and then your focus just shifts a little bit, like 10 minutes, 20, and then you just don't do like something productive. And that's what happens, and that's expected. But as I said, there is a subset of people who really want to challenge big things, and I think many people and who are ambitious want to do big things. Not just because of the money, it's also like to prove to yourself and the world that you can actually do something.
Absolutely. And I think that's the biggest motivation. Yeah, want to get like the mission. Absolutely. So for your current company, are you self-funding or is your company looking to raise some funding in the future? What's the plan there?
So we raised money for the spin, and we are basically still living off of this money. Also, we are self-funding, I would say, some operations. And we are basically in the early stages of thinking to raise some money. Not so sure how the market looks right now because the market has changed a lot. So some of the tier one.
Oh yeah, you raised during the bear market, yeah.
Two years ago, a little bit before. So it was kind of end of the last bull market. So that's where we raised. And the universe of companies investing has totally changed. So the tier one VC firms, which were tier one back then, some of them are not around anymore. Some of them are not investing anymore. I don't know. Like the universe has changed a lot. There's new companies, new funds, and we don't have so much of the relationships with the new companies because we were not fundraising like the last 2 years, and we are a little bit out of this fundraising market, but trying to re-enter now, basically, or let's say in the short-term future.
I see. Yeah, I have a feeling that this year will be, you know, like the resumption of the bull market, right? With now Bitcoin ETF and...
Who knows?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, who knows? Right? But yeah, well, we don't know, obviously. But, I don't know. I just have a feeling.
the announcement didn't move the needle a lot, right? So I don't know.
Yeah, I think it might be one of the like what, buy the rumor, sell the news. Maybe I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not a technical.
Or it was already priced in. I don't know.
Yeah, possibly. Anyway, very interesting. So I think the future. I mean, I see that for Web3 is like going to be multi-chain, right? But what is your vision? How do you see Web3 evolving in the future? What is the picture that you have for Web3?
So I think there is still a whole 10 or 20 years before us where we first have to get to Web 2.5. Like that's we are not even at, like Web3 and Web2 are completely out of sync. And you see that if you talk to normal technology users. Right. Now, when I say normal technology user, I mean someone who has TikTok, Instagram, uses maybe Slack at work, Discord for gaming, and YouTube for watching content, and Netflix, right? And probably some Facebook to be in touch with the grandparents. And I don't know, like that's like your typical technology user today. Everyone has heard about crypto. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Like everyone has heard about Bitcoin. Everyone has heard probably also about Ethereum. How much of the people who heard about it used it is a very small number. Like compared to how much people are using WhatsApp per day, I think that's like a totally different like number. And now the question is, how do you build apps who can touch into the crypto world, in the real crypto world? Like I'm not meaning like Web2 companies pretending to be crypto. I mean, how can something touch into the real crypto rails, like Ethereum or Solana or something, but for the normal user appear to as their normal app, right? With the UX they are used to, and not like bridging money, paying gas fees. You know, that's not normal user behavior, right? Like,
it's not normal. No, it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult, actually. UX,
so like slippage and MEV, and you know, like in order to navigate the DeFi landscape, I got a feeling that you need not a PhD, but you need some training, right?
So yeah, you do need some training. Yeah,
I would say it's like became so complicated. It reminds me of the traditional financial system. Right, if you want to navigate the traditional financial system on your own, it's pretty hard because there's legal stuff, there's all of these things, and that's why people prefer to go to a bank, and then the bank handles all of this for them. Right. So if you want to buy like a treasury bill, which is like a fairly easy way to go forward, it's like buying treasury bills is essentially similar to staking, right?
Yeah, very similar.
People would go to their retail bank and say, "I wanna invest into you," and then the banker would tell them, "Yeah, sure, we can do this package. Maybe you can add this, like add a little bit of that," and he creates you some sort of investment product where you say, "Okay, I'm gonna allocate $100 or $500, $1,000 per month to this investment product. And that's what people are used to. Doing this yourself is pretty complicated still. And this is, I think, very similar to DeFi now. So, and I don't think it will get easier. I think it will get even more complicated just because of the nature of finance. It's always been complicated. But what we really need is apps or ways for the masses to say, okay, I want to press a button and I want to get this. That's what they're used to, right? You go to Netflix and you press a button and I don't know, the movie comes. That's what, you don't have to reconfigure your Wi-Fi router to a specific frequency, bridge some information between like your one router to another, like, you know, like choose the right protocol, which is like having the lowest amount of congestion right now. And that's essentially what we have in crypto, right?
Yes. Like,
The gas fees are fluctuating. So it, one day it could be very cheap to use Polygon, but then the other, it could be very cheap to use Optimism. So like, explain this to a normal person, like that there is like 100 different protocols and all of them have different prices. Some of them can work together. Some of them cannot work together, right? So EVM can work together with EVM, but also in some instances they can't work together. Yeah. And then like, Solana can only work with Solana, but if you use Wormhole, it can work. Explain this to some normal person, it will be very good.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think it's, really, I feel like there's at least like a 1 to 3 month training, depending on how fast you will learn. Right? If someone wanted to be a DeFi user,
exactly.
In general, like and dedicated
for,
training.
For the public, I think we need to get to this stage where we will have the first consumer apps, which will make it possible to tap into crypto. And I think there is two dimensions to this. One is real finance, where you want to say, okay, here is like a consumer app for financial stuff. This is would be the like, natural use case for crypto. But I also think there is another use case. And the other use case is what crypto essentially does is it gives technology a new dimension. Because for now, technology has always been only about information, right? And content, right? It's but replicable, right? So this is very important. So in a sense, Spotify, Netflix, it's all of these things. It's centralized, it's replicable. You don't have a dimension of value towards it, right? The dimension of value is outside of technology. The dimension is value is handled by the financial sector. So you pay to Netflix your monthly subscription, but this is not part of Netflix. It's outside of Netflix. Right? Netflix gives you the tech and you pay them to access their platform $10, right? Or like $20.
Yeah.
With traditional payment rails, like with US dollars, etc. But I think what could happen in the future is adding a dimension of value native to technology. So if you watch 10 movies a day, you get 10 Netflix tokens, right? If you invite 5 friends to Netflix, you get 5 Netflix tokens. If you do the KPIs Netflix needs, you get some reward, which is not dollars, which is the native digital asset, non-replicable asset of this platform. And this would change a lot of the technological landscape because then people would be paid in a non-replicable asset for the time they're spending with technology. And I think we are going to that future, right? Because attention is everything in today's world. And if, in let's say I want to build a competitor to, right? So Dota 2, hundreds of hours are spent there by people, or League of Legends, or thousands of hours, right? So my cousin is a pro gamer. I think he spends like 12 hours a day playing Dota.
Easily,
Imagine if I would build the same exact replica of Dota, but also give my cousin for every hour played a Dota token, whatever. Why would he then still play Dota? He would probably come to me, right? Because his time would be rewarded by some native asset, which then, if they can build in some mechanic how he can spend the token, or let's say, like how this token becomes valuable in some sense. Like maybe you can stake it or whatever, or pay something with it for other people to become relevant. Then you have created like a native currency of this technological platform, which gives you additional benefit, right? And then people can only live, I assume, in the future. There will be like a whole economy for people to only live doing those things. Like I'm giving attention to three or four technology products, and I'm being paid in their native token, which I can then swap for Ethereum, which I can swap for Solana, which I can swap for Bitcoin, USDT, USDC. And these tokens should be tradable on the like traditional rails of DeFi, etc. And then you're kind of giving people a new way to make a living, right? So you can only live by using technology.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think what you said remind me a lot of the last bull run, like the play to earn games, right?
Yeah, yeah, there's that was the first
like
indicator.
Axie Infinity, Infinity, like people will actually make a living out of it, right?
Yeah,
playing. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, nothing against Axie Infinity. I mean, I have never played it, but what I want to say is it was not the AAA game.
Yeah,
it was not.
No,
like
it was not.
That
was
they
not
have built.
Yeah.
It was essentially similar to Flappy Bird, right? So, but you were being paid to play it, and people were going massively inside there. Now imagine a AAA game like Dota or League of Legends, which people would play anyways, giving you a token for your efforts, which is not replicable, etc. With this dimension of scarcity. Now this I think will be a huge thing in the coming years, because people are spending more and more time on the screens, more and more time, and this will only get amplified with AR, VR, you know, where you will be not even going outside of your room wearing an AR or VR headset. I think this will only get more and more and more. What do we need for that? Well, we need to make it work, right? So it's, for now, I haven't seen a lot of applications to actually really work.
Yeah, so I'm sure we'll be seeing some more interesting things in the future. I think which segues perfectly into my signature question is that how can we as developers, builders, like what can we do to onboard 1 billion people into Web3?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, the complexity of building has to be streamlined, right? First, you have to make the crypto world streamlined in a way as it is now with the internet. I mean, in the early days of the internet, you had all of these challenges we have now. Different the communication protocols, different this, different that. Like all of this was kind of being still built out, and we are kind of in this phase roughly, right? We are getting more and more towards some streamlining, right? So now CCIP is out. I mean, we are building multi-VM. Ethereum is like all of these things are kind of becoming more and more of like a system which works together, right? And not some random like, you know, systems which don't work together at all. So this is the first step. And then it will be easier to abstract all of this, you know, and say, okay, let's build something for users which they can understand, where they don't have to sign up for. Like Privy is a very good example, right? You're getting a wallet, but you don't see the wallet. You can log in with email, etc. This is the way forward, right? So you will have to make it very easy for the normal standard user and giving him some benefit he couldn't get at Snapchat, or he can't get at TikTok, or he can't get at Netflix, or he can't get at League of Legends. So, and that benefit in most cases will be a nice smart token which he can use and maybe even make a living out of it.
Yeah, and I think the topic of tokenomics, right, probably have to come into play, because
this can change a lot of verticals. Like for example, the private equity firm I was in before, we were like heavily, or one of the owners of one of the largest online dating platforms in the world. And dating is such a fascinating sector, right? So we were like into elite date, right? So people who,
like
not
very special
me, the
niche.
Company, the company we kind of had bought was like a cash machine, right? Because it was built for people who are career-wise in a very interesting place, right? They finished maybe their PhDs or their masters or their bachelors. They are working and they just want to find something serious. They're like, most of the users were like 35 to 40 years old. So they just wanted to find something serious, not Tinder, not like, you know, all of this. Just the main factor for them why they used our platform was the price. But not because it was cheap, but because it was expensive. Because the expensive onboarding eliminated a lot of the people who were not serious.
Yeah.
So
makes sense.
Let's say you would have to pay, I don't know how much now, but like approximately $200 to $500 to log in into the platform. You would have to at least spend 2 hours.
Month, per year? Per month or per year?
I think it was monthly, yeah.
Okay.
So you would fill out like a massive online form, like, I don't know, hundreds of questions, pay a lot of money, but they were extremely successful in marrying people. So in their office, they had a whole wall of married couples who met with that platform. Because what they did, they kind of eliminated all of the people who are not serious with the prize, and then they took all the data they need to make a profile out of you and matched you with a person who is similar to you. And want something serious. And after 2 or 3 days, people found their match, right? Like they were for something serious. Now, you see that money in traditional dating obviously has a role, right? So you cannot, I mean, that's just a proof that money somehow has a role in dating. Now, tokens are kind of programmable money. How will this change the dating industry? Like, I assume in a lot of ways, right? So this is a huge design space smart people can innovate on the mechanics of current dating, and how can they implement, for example, some token or programmable money into that? Because it is a part of date, and it is a part of everyday life. Like, money is a part of everyday life. And what we have in the crypto space is basically programmable money, which is native to the internet and native to technology. And I think there will be hundreds of new use cases coming up, which will be innovative to transform the traditional way how we live today.
Because I think that's what most people think crypto is good for, right? But I think that, there's many use cases for it besides just speculation.
I mean, speculation will always exist, but speculation is also part of the normal economy, like stocks, right? That's also speculation, right? So, what I think, though, is that the regulators will kill the unregulated IDOs and kill the unregulated ICOs and kill unregulated stuff. What I mean by that is I assume that the regulator will say, okay, this is how you launch a token, and this is what you have to have on a rule set, and only like that you will not be in trouble. And that will eliminate a lot of the scams, I think. Because for now, it's super easy to just create a token and say whatever you want and sell it to people. And I think this is a little bit dangerous, right? So what you create here is you say anyone in the world can basically create some token, whatever they want to market it, like anything really. Like, I've seen tokens for AI, I've seen tokens for dogs, cats, whatever, right? So everyone is allowed to market it as they want. And then a lot of people just believe that because they think it's real, invest substantial money into that, and then they get disappointed because, on the other hand, there is not a real effort to actually do that. And I think that was also happening in the stock market in the early 2000s and late 1900s. Like, that was definitely a part of Wall Street. But then, like, part apart, they said, okay, you have to have this license, or you have to have this, or you have to have that in order to be able to have a IPO. And now it's effectively impossible to have like a fake IPO.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to have a company, you have to have a founder, you have to have public names, you have to have public, you know, disclosure of everything. And so this is protecting investors.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, I think that will only maybe happen in the US first, right? With all the regulation from SEC and other regulators, and then maybe slowly expanding to other countries. Because the way I see it right now is like...
You have it in China as well. I mean, I would say like the US, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, the European Union, and maybe Nigeria and like South Africa, like some of the hubs, the regional trading hubs, right? And I assume like in Africa, that would be like Nigeria, maybe Egypt a little bit, and in South Africa. And then like in Asia, it's definitely China, India, and Southeast Asia. And then you have Europe, which is like the European Union. You have the US. And then you have obviously Russia, but all of these countries have some regulation regarding stocks.
Yeah. Like,
even if you would go to, I don't know, some not tier one financial hub in the world, and like, let's say Croatia, like we are a super small country, I'm basically from Croatia living here. Even here you have some regulation about stock market. Like, you know, everywhere you go, you have some stock market which is regulated. And I hope for crypto that this will happen, because otherwise we will always be in the circle of retail not knowing what's going on. Because you have, if you open Dex tools, like every second there's a new token. So
yeah,
like, and then if you tell a normal user, okay, this token is good, but this is bad, like how can a normal person understand what's good and bad, like without having to go through 2 years of learning?
The barrier to entry is really high for users. I remember it took me like months to understand, you know, some basic Web3 concepts, right? And then from there I just explore on and so on. But yeah, I do hope that someday will be our space will be more reputable. But I do think that regulation is always move slower than technology, right? I mean, I'm sure you've seen it too.
No, of course.
So it would take time, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, at least have some ways to prevent super obvious scams, right? Like rug pulls. I mean, that's really damaging. I think
it is. Yeah.
My heart goes out to everyone who has been a victim of this, because that's really malicious. It's malicious behavior and should really be penalized, right? I understand if a project overpromises on something, underdelivers. That's fairly normal in business. That's basically every company out there, right? Everyone promises everything. Every entrepreneur goes to shows and wherever and presents their company in the best light. The reality is oftentimes not that, right? And that's kind of normal, right? Imagine Elon Musk coming out and saying, hey, you know what, my car is shit. Like, you know, that's not gonna happen. Like, he has to say all the best about Tesla. And people know that, but there is some substance beneath, right? There is some car you can drive, and there is some people working there, and there is, you know, something. But if you're going out and deliberately defraud people by saying, hey, this is a coin where you can invest in, and then you just rug pull it, ain't that criminal? That's stealing, basically. We have to start with the slowest hanging fruit and say, okay, the hacks and the malicious behavior of rug pulls, this has to be stopped. Like, that's the biggest risk and the biggest danger.
Yeah. I feel like we need cooperation of pretty much like every builders, exchanges, decentralized or centralized in the world, cooperate together, right? To fight this. It's it's an uphill battle. I mean, because I feel like somehow some of the scammers, they always have an upper hand, right? Like they know too much, and they also very.
I mean, they take capable, it as their business, right? Like imagine being a bank robber. I mean, it's similar, right? You would probably know how to rob a bank, right? Like, so you would know how security systems works, etc. And here is very similar, right? If you are a rug puller, a professional one, you will be knowledgeable about every little nuance, how to do that to maximize your profit.
Yeah, like how to mix money, how to escape, and how to you know, withdraw money. Yeah, all the things. Yeah, quite sad.
And this is large. I mean, this is a huge problem for us in the industry. Because if we can't get rid of this, people will not take us seriously. They will always think about this like as a scammy niche degen pool of people who can't get their shit together and it's like laughable. And I think that's our biggest issue in the industry is security and making sure that at least people understand that the risk they're exposing themselves to when they buy these shit coins is huge, right? At least you have to make sure of that. I think the wallets are great for this as well. Like if they flag just stuff and like, you know, Google Chrome, when you visit a website which is not HTTPS protected, it tells you, are you really sure you want to go there, right? Yeah. And then, like if you're really, really sure, then you have to click like 10 buttons. I think that would be a good way to say, okay, like, are you really sure you want to send money to that wallet address because in the or smart contract address because there is malicious code in the smart contract which can rattle you? So some people will maybe take the risk because they want to time their exit faster than the rug puller, right? We don't know, but at least give the people the warning. Ideally, a lot of
Like I said, I think that's why we do need the cooperation of everyone working together, right? On that space, someone like alerting and someone maybe, you know, flagging the incident, and we need the heroes. Anyway, it's a very tricky situation, but I do hope that it will improve over time. So before we close out, I have two more questions for you. One is, do you have any advice for people who want to begin their own Web3 company?
Yeah, first start working. Like, I think if you have never done something in Web3 and you want to start something, don't do it. Like, ideally go work for someone first. Like, get, you know, the feeling of what is required, it's very hard to learn stuff when you are from the outside and you say, hey, I'm just going to launch a Web3 startup. I don't think that's a good idea. I would say to 99% of the people, start out with a project which is already being successful or semi-successful or in the market, and learn there, go to a couple of conferences, speak to people, and then if you still want to build something, then build it. I think that's I would give that advice to everyone, basically. I mean, unless you are kind of, you know, one of 1%, and you kind of, but then you would be successful anywhere. Like, you can, then you don't need, like, the Web3 is just the industry you're in. Like, you could do biotech, you could do whatever you
want. Yeah, no, I think that's very sound advice. Yeah, makes sense. You need to know the industry, understand. Because I do think there's a lot of barrier to entry, right? And also, like, the industry knowledge you have to acquire first before you can begin. And you also have to understand the problems, right? Yeah.
Imagine you asked me in the car industry, automotive, like, what's the best way to build a car? Like, my advice would be go work for Volkswagen, right? Like, you know, for the first 10 years. Like, and then once you've been an engineer there for 10 years, or Tesla or somewhere, or a few years at least, or a manager, whatever, then you can say, okay, within the automotive industry, I have found a niche, or I have found a demand or a need or whatever to place my product. Yeah. And that's normal for everyone. Like, I think if you would tell people on the street, hey, like, how would you build a automotive company, like, I think most of the people will tell you the same thing. In Web3, because the assumption is it's easy money, people just ape in and start a company, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it's very dangerous also to just jump in an industry without knowing anything about it. All you need to do your research.
Exactly.
Anyway, final question. Where can people follow you or your company? Feel free to share your
On Twitter, it's multivmio. And on Discord, it's multivmio, I think. The website is multivm.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I'll make sure to share it in the show notes below once it's so live, so that people can.
I mean, on multivmio, all the links are listed.
Awesome. Very easy to remember name too, as well. Ivan, it's been a lot of fun today talking to you.
It's been
awesome. Thank you so learning much. About what to do. Thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome. Cool. You too. Bye-bye.
And we are back to my studio. What do you guys think about this episode with Ivan, CBO of MultivM? As you guys may already know, I'm actually a big fan of 0 to 1 project and company that is building Moonshot, and of which MultiVM is certainly one like that in the Web3 space. For the next episode, we'll be talking to Jeremiah and Jose from Virtual Lab, who's building a project to help improve the UX of Web3. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe, because it would mean a lot to me. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.